Beth Goldsmith.
Jeff, it's Suzanne Delbanco from Catalyst for Payment Reform. How are you doing?
I'm well.
Thanks for picking up the phone. So this is a little bit of an unusual call. We have an audience listening in. So for their sake, can you just introduce yourself a little bit further and provide some information on your background for the listeners?
Right. Well, the Cliff Notes version, I've worked in the healthcare system for 42 years. I began as a planner and strategist and government relations person for a large academic health center. And then I taught in the business school at the University of Chicago for a long time, and also did a lot of strategy consulting. And a lot of the strategy consulting was in integrated delivery network development.
So that's good background for what I'm wanting to talk to you about today, which is the accountable care movement. How would you describe the state of that movement today? And don't hold back. You know, you can add your commentary and color as you will.
Well, as a bashful individual, I always hold back. I think the movement is stalled right now. I think there's the beginnings of a backlash among the provider community that has invested billions of dollars in this idea, most of which has not generated a return on the investment. I see people committed to value-based care, but they're kind of looking at what they've invested so far in terms of IT and staffing and meetings and all the rest of it and going, where's the beef?
And so when you talk about no return, are you talking about in financial terms only or in other ways as well?
Well, I think in both. I mean, I think the core idea was to save money as well as improve quality. And if there's no savings for a significant fraction of the people participating in it, what's the point? So if it doesn't save money for the federal government and for employers, well, then why do it? There's a limited bandwidth for clinical leaders and for managers, and limited capital available. So you want to put that capital and that time and attention to stuff that is going to generate a return.
So that sounds really out of step to me with what the health insurance companies are saying, you know, is a core part of their strategy, which is the growth of the number of ACOs across the country.
Measuring the number of ACOs is different than measuring the return.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, part of the problem with this idea, I think, is that it was targeted at the wrong problem. If healthcare costs per capita were growing at 5, 6, 7% a year, reducing the rate of growth as a policy target would have made a lot of sense. If the problem is affordability, then it's not clear that the ACO is the most efficient way to accomplish the goal of having more affordable care.
So how would you describe how providers adapted initially to the ACO movement and how they're reacting now? Are they ending contracts early? You know, how did they change how they were organized, and how has that continued, or how is it changing now?
Well, I think there were a lot of unrealistic expectations as to how many lives would end up flowing into narrow networks. There were a lot of us that believed that as much as half of the entire insured population in the country would be covered by these new networks. And it's clear now between the underperformance of the public exchanges and the stalling out of the private ones that, you know, if people gave up front-end discounts to get into these narrow networks, they're certainly not making it up on the volume. And a lot of these contracts just aren't economic. I think a lot of them are going to be terminated.
And what do you know about the impact of ACOs on quality? What evidence have you seen? I mean, obviously there's public evidence from the Medicare program, that's been released, but it's really hard to get insight in the private sector, in the commercial contracts, how these ACOs are faring.
An honest answer, I mean, I don't think anybody knows. I certainly haven't seen convincing data that quality has improved.
You know, one of the things that we've been doing at CPR is we put out just recently a standard plan ACO report, which is sort of a template we want health plans to use to report to their purchaser customers how their ACOs are faring, because it's so difficult to get any insight into that. So, you know, we're seeing the same thing as you, that it's really hard to tell. I was hoping you might have a magic, crystal ball to share with us.
But I mean, I began working on integrated care in the 80s and 90s. It was a lot of my consulting practice. And a lot of what my clients were worried about is, particularly in the West, they were losing patients to Kaiser, and they had no response. And part of the problem that we had with that work was, you know, we would try to put together an integrated delivery network, get the docs involved, in some cases get an insurance wraparound so that we could sell products into the commercial market and then discover that there were no clients. We couldn't sell the product. Mm. And, you know, for, I think with the commercial market now, I mean, you can talk, you know, the label value-based care is applied to stuff, some of which is, you know, an actual transfer of risk to the care system. But a lot of it is, frankly, just box checking with bonuses that are negligible relative to the cost that you have to put in place to get the data to the carriers and to the employers. So I think that's really been the problem. I mean, to talk about value-based care, it's a very slippery term. I don't see a lot of actual risk transfer going on. And that was my objection to the ACO. I mean, it was like they tried to take the idea of the HMO and remove all the stuff that engendered the backlash. So, you know, if you take out the risk, then, you know, what you're left with sort of resembles vegan barbecue. Or
you're talking to a vegetarian here.
Yeah, exactly. It's terrible, you know. Or gin and tonic without the gin. The risk is what forces you to make choices. The fact that you have a limited pool of money is what forces you to make choices. Some of those choices are unpopular choices. If you don't have the risk, if you don't have that downside risk, the constraint of a limited pool of dollars, then you don't really accomplish anything. So I think the design was flawed, and I said as much when this idea surfaced a decade ago.
And we've been measuring the different types of payment that are being used in the healthcare system, and there certainly is a preponderance of shared savings. It's outstripping pay for performance now, but very little shared risk. And you know, we
right.
hear that these contracts are going to migrate to shared risk over a 3 or maybe 5 year period.
Right.
And maybe we just haven't hit that moment yet. But I think you're right that there's been a lot less shared risk than I think those on the buy side of the market were hoping.
But even with the shared risk contracts, if the entry price was a 10 or a 20 or 30% discount off your rates, those discounts were premised on growth in volume that hasn't
right.
materialized.
Right.
So from the provider standpoint, these are bad deals mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. really aren't going to continue. And, you know, I don't know if you saw the American Medical Group Risk 3.0 survey that came out about 6 weeks ago. You know, if you add together full and partial cap, and remember what we're talking about here is the risk-bearing subset of the care system, you know, the Park Nicolets and Marshfield Clinics and mm-hmm. Geisinger's and all the rest mm-hmm. of it, capitation full and partial was less than 10%.
Right.
Their total revenues. This is
yep.
the risk-bearing part of the health system.
Yep.
And I think shared risk was another 4 or 5%, and it hadn't grown all that much in 2 years.
Yep.
So this idea that there's this tidal wave of risk coming is just not consistent with the numbers. It's not happening.
And do you think that there could be a difference made if employers were to decide that they were going to start offering ACO products or narrow network products that had, some kind of contingency around, you know, we'll enter into this and we'll offer it as an insurance product offering if there's shared risk built into the payment model?
You know, I'm really not sure it's going to make all that much difference. I mean, if employer cost trends took off, and again, you're much more in touch with this than I am on a day-to-day basis, my impression is that we're still in the mid to upper single digits. There's no crisis here. If it's obviously you don't want the numbers to grow, but you certainly don't want them to be at 10 or 15%. I don't see the degree of urgency required on the part of a lot of employers to make fundamental decisions or differences in their benefits policies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's tragic because I don't think they're getting value out of the way that care is being purchased now. I just don't think you get it through population-based models.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's there.
So my last question for you would be the obvious then. If employers are looking to contain costs and improve healthcare quality and they shouldn't focus on ACOs, where should they focus?
Well, I think there are grossly mispriced pieces of the healthcare system. I think particularly imaging and surgery. And, you know, why should employers be paying $3,000 to an academic health center for a magnetic resonance imaging scan when they can get it across the street for $450?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they're not rewarding the $450 MR provider, and it doesn't matter all that much to the patient which one they use, well, surprise, surprise, they're not going to get any savings.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the reference pricing model that you guys have been, you know, pretty high on for a number of years is the right way to go. And you focus on the high margin, high variation services where the prices really ought to come down. You know, when I talk about this in public audiences, I show them an iPhone and I say, you know, if healthcare made this, it'd cost $40,000. It wouldn't work on weekends and it wouldn't talk to any other device than than an iPhone. The entire margins of our health system pass through employer hands. They have tremendous leverage to begin wringing out some of the variation in cost and value that's out there. But if they're not willing to use that leverage in a very focused and constructive way, they're not going to get the savings, and we're not going to have a more efficient health system.
Well, I have to say I'm privileged to work with some of the more innovative and progressive purchasers out there who have been trying reference pricing and have been doing direct contracting for centers of excellence around certain surgeries that tend to be extremely expensive and you know, voluminous for their populations. But they're rare. They're few and far between. And so I couldn't agree more that more purchasers could put their hands on the steering wheel and try to take greater control over you know, some of this needless spending. And I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us today, Jeff. It's always interesting to talk to you. And I always know you won't hold back on sharing your opinion. So thank you for sharing that with us.
You bet, Suzanne.